this concept, the source is called bipolar varied fractal holism.
That's a mouthful.
It is. So we'll mostly use the shorthand, confluentism. It's fundamentally a new lens, a way of seeing the universe where influence doesn't just flow, you know, linearly.
Like A causes B causes C.
Right. Instead, it converges. It comes together from different directions. And the key challenge it tackles is understanding how we, as, you know, thinking, acting beings, process these simultaneous, often opposite influences. From the tiniest scale, the micro world.
Like particles or genes.
Yeah, exactly. And from the largest scale, the macro world. Society, the cosmos, the big picture stuff.
Okay, so why should you, listening right now, care about this?
Well, because confluentism really challenges how we think about, well, everything. Causality, how complexity arises, and that classic philosophical fight, free will versus determinism.
Mm-hmm.
If we're actually being shaped by everything all at once from opposite directions, mm-hmm. well, our current models might need a serious upgrade.
Okay, let's start digging into that, this bipolar dynamic you mentioned. The sources talk about micro, macro, and we, the observer, the participant in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And the standard view, the one we usually default to, is pretty linear, right? Micro stuff like our biology, our physics, that creates us.
Right. Bottom-up creation.
And then the macro world, like society or the universe, that influences us, kind of top-down influence.
And in that neat linear model, our actions seem clear-cut, too. We create complexity when we sort of move outwards towards the macro, building things, forming societies.
Expanding our world.
Exactly. And we simplify or maybe preserve memory when we look inwards towards the micro, focusing, remembering, reducing information. It's a tidy story.
It is tidy, maybe too tidy. The sources argue it's fundamentally incomplete. So where does confluentism shake things up?
Okay, this is where it gets really mind-bending. Confluentism introduces what the sources call the be-fluent perspective. Forget simple back and forth. The claim, and it's a bold one, is we consonantly, be-fluently create, complexify, and simplify in two opposite directions at the same time.
Whoa, okay, say that again. Be-fluent, by confluence. Let's translate that. Does it mean we're getting hit by two opposing streams of influence simultaneously?
That's a good way to put it.
Like maybe a river pulling us downstream towards simplicity, the micro level stuff, but also pushing us upstream towards complexity, the macro stuff, all at once.
That river analogy works quite well, actually. Think of yourself right now. You are, in this view, a confluence, a meeting point.
Okay.
Of micro R influences your genetics, your biology are constantly working, simplifying incoming data into, you know, manageable functions, keeping you structured, preserving you.
Right, maintaining the status quo.
But at the exact same moment, micro R influences societal norms, environmental cues, everything out there are pushing you to adapt, to make complex choices, to change your behavior, complexifying you.
So we're being determined and we're determining, simplifying and complexifying all the time.
All at the same time. That's the core idea of bifluent by confluence.
That actually feels quite intuitive when you stop and think about it. But you're right, we really resist that idea, don't we? The sources mention this big psychological barrier. Why is it so hard for us to accept this duality?
Yeah, it seems to boil down to what the sources call egolatry willing.
Egolatry, like self-worship.
Sort of, yeah. It's our deep-seated need to believe we're the ultimate authors of our own story, masters of our fate.
Okay.
So we find it easy to accept the micro-influence. We know we have biological limits. Physics applies to us. That makes sense within a materialist view.
Right. That fits. We're made of stuff. Stuff has rules.
But accepting the macro influence as a source, not just an influence, but something that actively creates and, crucially, simplifies us.
Yeah.
That's the hard part.
That implies more determinism from the outside.
Exactly. If we admit the macro pole isn't just a backdrop, but is actively shaping us, structuring us, even simplifying us, that suggests a level of determinism that, frankly, scares us.
Uh-huh.
It clashes hard with our anti-deterministic bias, our desire for total freedom, the egolatry willing. We want to be the special ones, moving out from the micro, creating everything ourselves. Not also being, well, simplified or shaped by something bigger, something cosmic.
It's an ego thing. We worry that accepting that macro pull means giving up our agency completely.
Yeah, so we tend to dismiss it. Call it fatalism, which is a much simpler, easier target to knock down than grappling with complex, confluent determination.
That resistance, that fear of determinism, it leads us right into the next part, doesn't it? The philosophical landscape confluentism is trying to navigate.
It does.
The sources lay out this kind of conceptual evolution, an in-evolution of thought, starting from one core problem.
And that core problem, the absolute bedrock challenge, is compatibilism.
Compatibilism, trying to make free will and determinism play nicely together.
Exactly. How do you square that circle? The sources argue that any system of rules or ethics, any deontology, ultimately has to wrestle with compatibilism at its root. And what's really neat is how they trace the development of human thought from that challenge. It's like watching ideas evolve to tackle this fundamental tension.
Walk us through that chain, because it seems to link things we normally keep separate, like religion and science.
Okay, so it starts with compatibilism, the basic need to reconcile freedom and fate. According to the sources, this naturally evolves into teleology.
Teleology, the study of purpose, final causes.
Precisely. Once you start thinking maybe determination and free will can coexist, the immediate next question is why? What's the point of it all? What's the purpose of this setup?
So teleology is chasing the why.
Exactly. And from chasing the why, you get theology. When people look for a really comprehensive why, and also what's the nature of this determined system, they developed divine frameworks. Theology defines that structure, often personified as God or creators.
Okay, makes sense. What's next?
Next up is philosophy. It sort of evolves from theology by shifting the focus more towards how things work and what they are, often trying to rationalize those divine structures or replace them with abstract principles, less dogma, more logic.
Right.
And finally, science continues that trajectory, zeroing in on the empirical how does stuff actually work and the observable, testable why of specific phenomena.
Wow. So it's one continuous thread of inquiry all bubbling up from that original knot.
Mm-hmm.
How do determinism and free will fit together?
That's the argument. And if you accept that chain.
Then the philosophical realist who talks about an objective reality out there.
And the theologian talking about an all-powerful deity.
They're essentially just using different kinds of teleology, different answers to why, that grew out of the same basic struggle with compatibilism.
That's the unifying insight confluentism offers here. It sees popular philosophy, like realism, often leaning on anti-deterministic teleologies, think reality, as this independent force we interact with.
We have freedom within reality.
Right. Whereas popular theologies tend to use deterministic teleologies, often centered on GA, as the ultimate determining cause.
God has a plan.
Exactly. Confluentism doesn't pick a side. It asks, how do these apparently opposing views conflue? How do they meet back at that shared root of compatibilism?
It suggests they're just two different partial takes on the same deep human need to find purpose in a world that feels both determined and free. Yeah, that's a potentially powerful way to reframe some longstanding debates.
It could be.
But okay, if that's the potential, why aren't we doing it? Our current ways of thinking, especially in academia, often seem to reinforce the divisions. Which brings us to segment three, the critique. The sources give this pretty blunt list a resume of popular flaws within the academia.
Yes, and most of these flaws, when you look closely, seem to circle back to that difficulty, that systemic inability in academic circles to handle determination without feeling like freedom is under attack.
Okay, let's look at flaw one. It says freedom is used to bully destiny as fatalism. What does that mean?
It means setting up a false fight. Instead of engaging with the sophisticated idea of complex determination, how micro and macro influences might shape possibilities, academics often attack the easiest, weakest version, fatalism. The idea that everything is rigidly preordained and you can't do anything about it.
Like a straw man argument.
Exactly. Yeah. You knock down the straw man of fatalism and declare victory for absolute freedom without ever grappling with the real, trickier concept of determination.
It's intellectually easier, I suppose. What about flaw two? Using determinism for reductionism. Finiting within an infinite entropy. That sounds complicated.
It sounds dense, but the idea is quite direct. It critiques the tendency to take deterministic laws, like in physics, and use them to chop reality up into neat, finite, predictable boxes. We try to reduce everything to simple cause and effect chains.
Trying to make everything measurable and contained.
Right. Even though concepts like entropy, and especially the measurement problem in quantum physics, strongly suggest that reality, at its edges, is infinite, chaotic, and resists being perfectly boxed up. Our measurements themselves affect the outcome.
So we're imposing finite limits on something fundamentally infinite or unpredictable.
That's the critique. We want the universe to be reducible. But the deeper we look, both micro and macro, the fuzzier those neat boundaries become.
Okay, and these flaws creep into how we use core physics concepts, too. Flaw four is about misapplying the uncertainty principle.
Yes. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is fundamentally about the limits of observation, right? You can't perfectly know a particle's position and momentum at the same time. It's a limit on measurement.
Got it.
But the sources argue it often gets misapplied way beyond that, specifically to teleology, to the very idea purpose or why.
How does that happen? How do you apply measurement limits to purpose?
Well, if you take the principle to mean that fundamental reality is inherently uncertain or fuzzy, and then you extend that fuzziness to the concept of purpose itself, you end up implying that any ultimate why must also be inherently uncertain or unknowable.
Ah, so it sidelines the search for purpose.
It effectively dismisses it, yeah. It turns purpose into a kind of statistical artifact of our limited view, rather than potentially a real foundational aspect of reality we should be investigating. It conveniently ignores that deep need for teleology we talked about earlier.
That's a subtle but really important distinction. Okay, what about flaw 3? It mentions the anthropic principle. The idea, the universe seems fine-tuned for life. It says strong versions are ignored, but also buzzed at the same time.
Right. This means we often rely on the implications of fine-tuning when it suits an argument maybe in cosmology or biology discussions. We kind of hint at purpose.
Like, isn't it amazing how perfect things are for us?
Exactly. But we shy away from rigorously defining or defending that purpose because doing so feels too... well, too teleological, too deterministic. It's like wanting the benefits of the argument without committing to its uncomfortable philosophical baggage.
An intellectual fudge, as you put it earlier.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And the final one, flaw 5, takes aim at how we define ourselves. Freedom and will are called rupturist speciesists.
Rupturist speciesists. Meaning?
It means we tend to define uniquely human things, like cognition and consciousness, using, frankly, vague buzzwords. And we position ourselves, humans, as the exceptions, the species that ruptures the normal, deterministic, confluent rules that seem to apply to everything else in the universe.
We're special. We break the mold.
That's the implicit claim. We define ourselves as uniquely undetermined, often without really solid, rigorous evidence, beyond just asserting it.
Which loops right back to that egalitary willing. The whole academic setup sometimes seems geared towards protecting human exceptionalism and this idea of radical freedom, even if it means twisting principles or dodging hard questions.
And that systemic resistance, yeah, that insistence on keeping things in rival camps, is precisely why confluentism issues its core instruction. The more rivalized dichotomy, the better to confluent it.
Use the conflict itself as the raw material.
Exactly. Confluentism sees that tension, that rivalry, not as a problem, but as evidence. Evidence that there's a deeper unified reality that both sides are only partially grasping.
You see these rivalries everywhere, right? The sources mention idealism versus cognitivism versus panpsychism in psychology.
Three different ways of looking at the mind, all potentially partial.
Or Darwinism versus pleomorphism in biology, different takes on how evolution works.
Again, maybe just describing different aspects, different scales of the same complex micro-e-macro process.
And this connects to the idea of centroidal philosophers.
Yes, those thinkers, particularly in philosophy of science, who naturally find themselves in the middle ground between pure realism, reality is entirely independent, and anti-realism, reality is mostly subjective or constructed.
They're instinctively more confluentist.
You can say that. They recognize that the truth likely lies in how those two poles, independent reality and subjective perception, interact and meet. They embrace the confluence.
So confluentism isn't about picking winner and loser between rival ideas. It's about mapping how they both emerge from and point towards a single, more complex, underlying reality. It turns the rivalry into a tool.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
So to kind of wrap this up for you, the listener, the core takeaway here is that confluentism proposes this really fundamental shift in perspective. We're not just actors on a stage. We are constantly, simultaneously simplifying inputs from the micro world and complexifying our interactions with the macro world.
While also being shaped, influenced, even simplified by both of those poles all at once.
It's a dynamic, two-way, simultaneous flow.
So what does this mean practically? Maybe the next time you run into one of those big debates like, say, nature versus nurture or individual freedom versus social structures.
Classic dichotomies.
Yeah. Instead of picking a side, maybe pause and ask, could these two apparently opposing views actually be describing different points on that same continuous micro-e-macro line? Are they partial truths that need to be brought together?
Are they both reflecting aspects of a larger confluent reality that includes both determination and anti-determination?
A way to find the bigger picture.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And maybe one final thought to leave you with, something provocative from the sources. It touches on that idea of simplification.
Okay.
The source notes that our own mental processes, how we filter information, create memories, simplify the buzzing confusion of the world to make sense of it. That this actually mimics how the complexus macro source simplify us.
Wait, our simplifying mimics the universe simplifying us?
That's the suggestion. So if we, as conscious beings, find it absolutely necessary to simplify reality just to be able to function and perceive, what does that imply about the nature of the ultimate macro source, the universe itself, that presumably must be simplified for creatures like us to even exist within it? What kind of complexity are we simplifying?